Chapter 10. The Tawdriness of the Miraculous and the Decline of Hell. The daughters of the high priest Aeneas changed whatever they chose into wheat, wine, or oil. Athalida, daughter of Mercury, was resuscitated several times. Aesculapius resuscitated Hippolytus. Hercules dragged Alcestis back from death. Ceres returned to the world after passing a fortnight in hell. The parents of Romulus and Remus were a god and a vestal virgin. The Palladium fell from heaven in the city of Troy. The hair of Berenice became a constellation. Give me the name of one people, among whom incredible prodigies were not performed, especially when few knew how to read and write. Voltaire, Miracles and Idolatry. An old fable concerns the comeuppance of a braggart, who was forever retelling the story of a truly stupendous leap that he had once made on the island of Rhodes. Never, it seemed, had there ever been witnessed such a heroic long jump. Though the teller never grew tired of the tale, the same could not be said of his audience. Finally, as he again drew breath to relate the story of the great feat, one of those present silenced him by saying gruffly, "Hic Rhodus, hic salta. Here is Rhodes. Jump here." In much the same way as prophets and seers and great theologians seem to have died out, so the age of miracles seems to lie somewhere in our past. If the religious were wise or had the confidence of their convictions, they ought to welcome the eclipse of this age of fraud and conjuring. But faith yet again discredits itself by proving to be insufficient to satisfy the faithful. Actual events are still required to impress the credulous. We have no difficulty in seeing this when we study the witch doctors and magicians and soothsayers of earlier or more remote cultures. Obviously it was a clever person who first learned to predict an eclipse and then to use this planetary event to impress and cow his audience. Ancient kings in Cambodia worked out the day on which the Mekong and the Bassac rivers would annually start to flood and conjoin, and under terrific water pressure, appear to actually reverse their flow back into the great lake at Tonle Sap. Relatively soon there was a ceremony at which the divinely appointed leader would duly appear and seem to order the waters to flow backward. Moses on the shore of the Red Sea could only have gaped at such a thing. In more modern times, the showman King Sihanouk of Cambodia exploited this same natural miracle to considerable effect. Given all that, it is surprising how petty some of the supernatural miracles now seem. As with spiritualist seances, which cynically offer burblings from the beyond to relatives of the late deceased, nothing truly interesting is ever said or done. To the story of Muhammad's night flight to Jerusalem, the hoofprint of his horse Borak is still allegedly to be seen on the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it would be unkind to make the obvious riposte that horses cannot and do not fly. It is more pertinent to notice that people, ever since the beginning of their long and exhausting journeys across the earth's surface, gazing for days at the rear end of a mule, have fantasized about speeding up the tedious process. Folkloric seven-league boots can give the wearer a spring in his step, but this is only tinkering with the problem. The real dream for thousands of years involved envy of the birds, feathered descendants of the dinosaurs, as we now know, and the yearning to fly. Chariots in the sky, angels that could glide freely on the thermals. It's only too easy to see the root of the wish. Thus the prophet speaks to the longing of every peasant who wishes that his beast could take wing and get on with it. But, given infinite power, one might have thought that a more striking or less simple-minded miracle could have been confected. Levitation plays a vast role in Christian fantasy as well, as the stories of the Ascension and the Assumption confirm. At that epoch, the sky was thought to be a bowl and its ordinary weather a source of portent or intervention. Given this pathetically limited view of the cosmos, the most trivial event could appear miraculous, while an event that would truly astonish us, such as the sun ceasing to move, could yet appear as a local phenomenon. Assuming that a miracle is a favourable change in the natural order, the last word on the subject was written by the Scottish philosopher David Hume, who granted us free will in the matter. A miracle is a disturbance or interruption in the expected and established course of things. This could involve anything from the sun rising in the west to an animal suddenly bursting into the recitation of verse. Very well, then. Free will also involves decision. If you seem to witness such a thing, there are two possibilities. The first is that the laws of nature have been suspended, in your favour. The second is that you are under a misapprehension, or suffering from a delusion. Thus the likelihood of the second must be weighed against the likelihood of the first. If you only hear a report of the miracle from a second or third party, the odds must be adjusted accordingly before you can decide to credit a witness who claims to have seen something that you did not see. And if you are separated from the sighting by many generations, and have no independent corroboration, the odds must be adjusted still more drastically. Again, we might call upon the trusty Occam, who warned us not to multiply unnecessary contingencies. Thus, let me give one ancient and one modern example, the first being bodily resurrection, and the second being UFOs. Miracles have declined in their wondrous impact since ancient times. Moreover, the more recent ones that have been offered us have been slightly tawdry. The notorious annual liquefaction of the blood of San Gennaro in Naples, for example, is a phenomenon that can easily be, and has been, repeated by any competent conjurer. Great secular magicians like Harry Houdini and James Randi have demonstrated with ease that levitation, firewalking, water divining, and spoon bending can all be performed under laboratory conditions in order to expose the fraud and to safeguard the unwary customer from a fleecing. Miracles, in any case, do not vindicate the truth of the religion that practices them. Aaron supposedly vanquished Pharaoh's magicians in an open competition, but did not deny that they could perform wonders as well. However, there has not been a claimed resurrection for some time, and no shaman who purports to do it has ever agreed to reproduce his trick in such a way as to stand a challenge. Thus we must ask ourselves, has the art of resurrection died out, or are we relying on dubious sources? The New Testament is itself a highly dubious source. One of Professor Barton Ehrman's more astonishing findings is that the account of Jesus' resurrection in the Gospel of Mark was only added many years later. But according to the New Testament, the thing could be done in an almost commonplace way. Jesus managed it twice in other people's cases by raising both Lazarus and the daughter of Jairus, and nobody seems to have thought it worthwhile to interview either survivor to ask about their extraordinary experiences. Nor does anyone seem to have kept a record of whether or not or how these two individuals died again. If they stayed immortal, then they joined the ancient company of the wandering Jew, who was condemned by early Christianity to keep walking forever after he met Jesus on the Via Dolorosa, this misery being inflicted on a mere bystander in order to fulfill the otherwise unfulfilled prophecy that Jesus would come again in the lifetime of at least one person who'd seen him the first time around. On the same day that Jesus met that luckless vagrant, he was himself put to death with revolting cruelty, at which time, according to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 27, verses 52 to 53, the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose, and came out of the graves after his resurrection, and went into the holy city, and appeared unto many. This seems incoherent, since the corpses apparently rose both at the time of the death on the cross and of the resurrection, but it is narrated in the same matter-of-fact way as the earthquake, the rending of the veil of the temple, two other events that did not attract the attention of any historian, and the reverent comments of the Roman centurion. This supposed frequency of resurrection can only undermine the uniqueness of the one by which mankind purchased forgiveness of sins, and there is no cult or religion before or since, from Osiris to vampirism to voodoo, that does not rely on some innate belief in the undead. To this day, Christians disagree as to whether the Day of Judgment will give you back the old wreck of a body that has already died on you, or will re-equip you in some other form. For now, and on a review even of the claims made by the faithful, one can say that resurrection would not prove the truth of the dead man's doctrine, nor his paternity, nor the probability of still another return in fleshly or recognizable form. Yet again also, too much is being proved. The action of a man who volunteers to die for his fellow creatures is universally regarded as noble. The extra claim not to have really died makes the whole sacrifice tricky and meretricious. Thus, those who say Christ died for my sins when he did not really die at all are making a statement that is false in its own terms. Having no reliable or consistent witnesses in anything like the time period needed to certify such an extraordinary claim, we are finally entitled to say that we have a right, if not an obligation, to respect ourselves enough to disbelieve the whole thing. That is, unless or until superior evidence is presented, which it has not been, and exceptional claims demand exceptional evidence. I have spent much of my life as a correspondent and long ago became used to reading first-hand accounts of the very same events I had witnessed, written by people I otherwise trusted, which did not accord with my own. In my days as a Fleet Street correspondent, I even read stories in print under my own name which were not recognisable to me, once the sub-editors had finished with them. And I have interviewed some of the hundreds of thousands of people who claim to have had direct encounters with spacecraft, or the crew of spacecraft from another galaxy. Some of these are so vivid and detailed, and so comparable with other depositions from other people who cannot have compared notes, that a few impressionable academics have proposed that we grant them the presumption of truth. but here is the obvious Occamist reason why it would be utterly wrong to do so. If the huge number of contacts and abductees are telling even a particle of truth, then it follows that their alien friends are not attempting to keep their own existence a secret. Well, in that case, why do they never stay still for anything more than a single-shot photo? There has never been an uncut roll of film offered, let alone a small piece of a metal unavailable on Earth, or a tiny sample of alien tissue. And sketches of the beings have a consistent anthropomorphic resemblance to those offered in science fiction comics. Since travel from Alpha Centauri, the preferred origin, would involve some bending of the laws of physics, even the smallest particle of matter would be of enormous use and would have a literally earth-shattering effect, instead of which, nothing. Nothing, that is, except the growth of a huge new superstition, based on a belief in occult texts and shards that are available only to a favoured few. Well, I've seen that happen before. The only responsible decision is to suspend or withhold judgment until the votaries have come up with something that is not merely childish. Extend this to the present day, where the statues of virgins or saints are sometimes said to weep or bleed. Even if I could not easily introduce you to people who can produce this identical effect in their spare time, using pig fat or other materials, I would still ask myself why a deity should be content to produce such a paltry effect. As it happens, I am one of the very few people who has ever taken part in the examination of a sainthood cause, as the Roman Catholic Church calls it. In June of 2001, I was invited by the Vatican to testify at a hearing on the beatification of Agnes Bujashu, an ambitious Albanian nun who had become well-known under the nom de guerre of Mother Teresa. Although the then-pope had abolished the famous office of devil's advocate, the better to confirm and canonize an enormous number of new saints, the Church was still obliged to seek testimony from critics, and thus I find myself representing the devil, as it were, pro bono. I had already helped expose one of the miracles connected with the work of this woman. The man who originally made her famous was a distinguished, if rather silly, British evangelist, later a Catholic, named Malcolm Muggeridge. It was his BBC documentary, Something Beautiful for God, which launched the Mother Teresa brand on the world in 1969. The cameraman for this film was a man named Ken McMillan, who had won high praise for his work on Lord Clark's great art history series, Civilization. His understanding of colour and lighting was of a high order. Here is the story, as Muggeridge told it, in the book that accompanied the film. Mother Teresa's home for the dying is dimly lit by small windows high up in the walls, and Ken McMillan was adamant that filming was quite impossible there. We only had one small light with us, and to get the place adequately lighted in the time at our disposal was quite impossible. It was decided that nonetheless Ken should have a go, but by way of insurance he took as well some film in an outside courtyard where some of the inmates were sitting in the sun. In the processed film, the part taken inside was bathed in a particularly beautiful soft light, whereas the part taken outside was rather dim and confused. I myself am absolutely convinced that the technically unaccountable light is in fact the kindly light that Cardinal Newman refers to in his well-known exquisite hymn. Muggeridge concluded that this is precisely what miracles are for, to reveal the inner reality of God's outward creation. I'm personally persuaded that Ken recorded the first authentic photographic miracle. I fear I talked and wrote about it to the point of tedium. He was certainly correct in that last sentence. By the time he had finished, he'd made Mother Teresa into a world-famous figure. My contribution was to check out and put into print the direct verbal testimony of Ken McMillan, the cameraman himself. Here it is. During Something Beautiful for God, there was an episode where we were taken to a building that Mother Teresa called the House of the Dying. Peter Schaefer, the director, said, "Ah, well, it's very dark in here. Do you think we can get something?" And we'd just taken delivery at the BBC of some new film made by Kodak, which we hadn't had time to test before we left. So I said to Peter, "Well, we may as well have a go." So we shot it. And when we got back several weeks later, a month or two later, we're sitting in the Rush's Theatre at Ealing Studios, and eventually up come the shots of the House of the Dying. And it was surprising. You could see every detail. And I said, "That's amazing, that's extraordinary." And I was going to go on to say, you know, three cheers for Kodak. I didn't get a chance to say that, though, because Malcolm, sitting in the front row, spun around and said, "It's divine light! It's Mother Teresa! You'll find it's divine light, old boy!" And 3 or 4 days later I found that I was being phoned by journalists from London newspapers who were saying things like, "We hear you've just come back from India with Malcolm Muggeridge, and you were the witness of a miracle." So a star was born. For these and for my other criticisms, I was invited by the Vatican into a closed room containing a Bible, a tape recorder, a Monsignor, a deacon, and a priest, and asked if I could throw any light of my own on the matter of the servant of God, Mother Teresa. But even as they appeared to be asking me this in good faith, their colleagues on the other side of the world were certifying the necessary miracle that would allow the beatification, prelude to full canonization, to go forward. Mother Teresa died in 1997. On the first anniversary of her death, two nuns in the Bengali village of Raigunj claimed to have strapped an aluminum medal of the departed, a medal that had supposedly been in contact with her dead body, to the abdomen of a woman named Monica Bezra. This woman, who was said to be suffering from a large uterine tumour, was thereupon quite cured of it. It will be noticed that Monica is a Catholic girl's name not very common in Bengal, and thus that probably the patient and certainly the nuns were already Mother Teresa fans. This definition would not cover Dr. Manju Murshed, the superintendent of the local hospital, nor Dr. T.K. Biswas and his gynecologist colleague, Dr. Ranjan Mustafi. All three came forward to say that Mrs. Bezra had been suffering from tuberculosis and an ovarian growth and had been successfully treated for both afflictions. Dr. Murshed was particularly annoyed at the numerous calls he had received from Mother Teresa's order, the missionaries of charity, pressing him to say that the cure had been miraculous. The patient herself did not make a very impressive interview subject, talking at high speed because, as she put it, she might otherwise forget, and begging to be excused questions because she might have to remember. Her own husband, a man named Selku Murmu, broke silence after a while to say that his wife had been cured by ordinary, regular medical treatment. Any hospital supervisor in any country will tell you that patients sometimes make astonishing recoveries, just as apparently healthy people often fall inexplicably and gravely ill. Those who desire to certify miracles may wish to say that such recoveries have no natural explanation. But this does not at all mean that there is therefore a supernatural one. In this case, however, there was nothing even remotely surprising in Mrs. Bezra's return to health. Some familiar disorders had been treated with well-known methods. Extraordinary claims were being made without even ordinary evidence. Yet there will soon come a day in Rome when a vast and solemn ceremony will proclaim the sainthood of Mother Teresa as one whose intercession can improve upon medicine to the entire world. Not only is this a scandal in itself, but it will further postpone the day when Indian villagers cease to trust quacks and fakirs. In other words, many people will die needlessly as a result of this phony and contemptible miracle. If this is the best the Church can do, in a time when its claims can be checked by physicians and reporters, it isn't difficult to imagine what was rigged in past times of ignorance and fear when the priests faced less doubt or opposition. Once again, the razor of Occam is clean and decisive. When two explanations are offered, one must discard the one that explains the least or explains nothing at all, or raises more questions than it answers. The same goes for those occasions when the laws of nature are apparently suspended in a way that does not offer joy or apparent consolation. Natural disasters are actually not violations of the laws of nature, but rather are part of the inevitable fluctuations within them. But they have always been used to overawe the gullible with the mightiness of God's disapproval. Early Christians operating in zones of Asia Minor where earthquakes were and are frequent would rally crowds when a pagan temple fell down and urge them to convert while there was still time. The colossal volcanic explosion at Krakatoa in the late 19th century provoked an enormous swing toward Islam among the terrified population of Indonesia. All the holy books talk excitedly of floods, hurricanes, lightning, and other portents. After the terrible Asian tsunami of 2005 and after the inundation of New Orleans in 2006, quite learned and serious men, such as the Archbishop of Canterbury, were reduced to the level of stupefied peasants when they publicly agonized over how to interpret God's will in the matter. But if one makes the simple assumption, based on absolutely certain knowledge, that we live on a planet that is still cooling, has a molten core, faults and cracks in its crust, and a turbulent weather system, then there is simply no need for any such anxiety. Everything is already explained. I fail to see why the religious are so reluctant to admit this. It would free them from all the futile questions about why God permits so much suffering. But apparently this annoyance is a small price to pay in order to keep alive the myth of divine intervention. The suspicion that a calamity might also be a punishment is further useful in that it allows an infinity of speculation. After New Orleans, which suffered from a lethal combination of being built below sea level and neglected by the Bush administration, I learned from a senior rabbi in Israel that it was revenge for the evacuation of Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip. and from the mayor of New Orleans, who had not performed his own job with exceptional prowess, that it was God's verdict on the invasion of Iraq. You can nominate your own favourite sin here, as did the Reverends Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell after the immolation of the World Trade Center. In that instance, the proximate cause was to be sought and found in America's surrender to homosexuality and abortion. Some ancient Egyptians believed that sodomy was the cause of earthquakes. I expect this interpretation to revive with especial force when the San Andreas Fault next gives a shudder under the Gomorrah of San Francisco. When the debris had eventually settled on Ground Zero, it was found that two pieces of mangled girder still stood in the shape of a cross, and much wondering comment resulted. Since all architecture has always involved crossbeams, it would be surprising only if such a feature did not emerge. I admit that I would have been impressed if the wreckage had formed itself into a Star of David, or a Star and Crescent, but there is no record of this ever having occurred anywhere, even in places where local people might be impressed by it. And remember, miracles are supposed to occur at the behest of a being who is omnipotent, as well as omniscient and omnipresent. One might hope for more magnificent performances than ever seem to occur. The evidence for faith, then, seems to leave faith looking even weaker than it would if it stood, alone and unsupported, all by itself. What can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. This is even more true when the evidence eventually offered is so shoddy and self-interested. The argument from authority is the weakest of all arguments. It is weak when it is asserted at second or third hand, the good book says. And it is even weaker when asserted at first hand, as every child knows, who has heard a parent say, "Because I say so," and as every parent knows, who's heard himself reduced to uttering words he once found so unconvincing. Nonetheless, it takes a certain leap of another kind to find oneself asserting that all religion is made up by ordinary mammals and has no secret or mystery to it. Behind the veil of Oz, there's nothing but bluff. Can this really be true? As one who's always been impressed by the weight of history and culture, I do keep asking myself this question. Was it all in vain, then, the great struggle of the theologians and scholars, and the stupendous efforts of painters and architects and musicians, to create something lasting and marvellous that would testify to the glory of God? Not at all. It does not matter to me whether Homer was one person or many, or whether Shakespeare was a secret Catholic or a closet agnostic. I should not feel my own world destroyed if the greatest writer about love and tragedy and comedy and morals was finally revealed to have been the Earl of Oxford all along, though I must add that soul authorship is important to me, and I would be saddened and diminished to learn that Bacon had been the man. Shakespeare has much more moral salience than the Talmud or the Koran, or any account of the fearful squabbles of Iron Age tribes, but there's a great deal to be learned and appreciated from the scrutiny of religion, and one often finds oneself standing atop the shoulders of distinguished writers and thinkers who were certainly one's intellectual and sometimes even one's moral superiors. Many of them in their own time had ripped away the disguise of idolatry and paganism, and even risked martyrdom for the sake of disputes with their own co-religionists. However, a moment in history has now arrived when even a pygmy such as myself can claim to know more, through no merit of his own, and to see that the final ripping of the whole disguise is overdue. Between them, the sciences of textual criticism, archaeology, physics, and molecular biology have shown religious myths to be false and man-made, and have also succeeded in evolving better and more enlightened explanations. The loss of faith can be compensated by the newer and finer wonders that we have before us, as well as by immersion in the near-miraculous work of Homer and Shakespeare and Milton and Tolstoy and Proust, all of which was also man-made, though one sometimes wonders, as in the case of Mozart. I can say this as one whose own secular faith has been shaken and discarded, not without pain. When I was a Marxist, I did not hold my opinions as a matter of faith, but I did have the conviction that a sort of unified field theory might have been discovered. The concept of historical and dialectical materialism was not an absolute, and it did not have any supernatural element, but it did have its messianic element in the idea that an ultimate moment might arrive, and it most certainly had its martyrs and saints and doctrinaires, and, after a while, its mutually excommunicating rival papacies. It also had its schisms and inquisitions and heresy hunts. I was a member of a dissident sect that admired Rosa Luxemburg and Leon Trotsky, and I can say definitely that we also had our prophets. Rosa Luxemburg seemed almost like a combination of Cassandra and Jeremiah when she thundered about the consequences of the First World War. And the great three-volume biography of Leon Trotsky by Isaac Deutscher was actually entitled The Prophet, in his three stages of being armed, unarmed, and outcast. As a young man, Deutscher had been trained for the rabbinate and would have made a brilliant Talmudist, as would Trotsky. Here is what Trotsky says, anticipating the Gnostic Gospel of Judas, about the way that Stalin took over the Bolshevik Party. Of Christ's 12 apostles, Judas alone proved to be traitor. But if he had acquired power, he would have represented the other 11 apostles as traitors, and also all the lesser apostles, whom Luke numbers as 70. And here in Deutsch's chilling words is what happened when the pro-Nazi forces in Norway forced the government to deny Trotsky asylum and deport him once again, to wander the world until he met death. The old man met with the Norwegian Foreign Minister, Trygve Lie, and others, and then Trotsky raised his voice so that it resounded through the halls and corridors of the ministry. This is your first act of surrender to Nazism in your own country. You will pay for this. You think yourselves free and secure to deal with the political exile as you please, but the day is near, remember this, the day is near when the Nazis will drive you from your country, all of you. Trygve Lie shrugged at this odd piece of soothsaying. Yet, after less than 4 years, the same government had indeed to flee from Norway before the Nazi invasion. And as the ministers and their aged King Hakon stood on the coast, huddled together and waiting anxiously for a boat that was to take them to England, they recalled with awe Trotsky's words, as a prophet's curse come true. Trotsky had a sound materialist critique that enabled him to be prescient, not all of the time by any means, but impressively so on some occasions, and he certainly had a sense, expressed in his emotional essay, Literature and Revolution, of the unquenchable yearning of the poor and oppressed to rise above the strictly material world and to achieve something transcendent. For a good part of my life I had a share in this idea that I have not yet quite abandoned. But there came a time when I could not protect myself and indeed did not wish to protect myself from the onslaught of reality. Marxism, I conceded, had its intellectual and philosophical and ethical glories, but they were in the past. Something of the heroic period might perhaps be retained, but the fact had to be faced. There was no longer any guide to the future. In addition, the very concept of a total solution had led to the most appalling human sacrifices and to the invention of excuses for them. Those of us who had sought a rational alternative to religion had reached a terminus that was comparably dogmatic. What else was to be expected of something that was produced by the close cousins of chimpanzees? Infallibility? Thus, dear reader, if you have come this far and found your own faith undermined, as I hope, I am willing to say that to some extent I know what you are going through. There are days when I miss my old convictions as if they were an amputated limb. But in general I feel better, and no less radical, and you will feel better too, I guarantee, once you leave hold of the doctrinaire and allow your chainless mind to do its own thinking.